Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Taxidermy turns out to be a complex subject with a lot going on. Who knew? There are even people getting animals mounted for display who don't hunt. They just want to have a piece of formerly alive Alaska in their homes. On today's show, I have Alaska's most famous taxidermist, a guy with a big taxidermy shop who also made his name in reality TV and is now working on creating new shows even as he keeps stuffing every kind of exotic creature. His name is Russell Knight. And then we'll hear from Sam Huckstep, who is a member of the next generation of taxidermy. She's a young woman who loves wildlife and art and is doing taxidermy in her house and finding all the work she can handle. The new generation of young hunters and outdoor folks is making this old art form bigger than ever. Finally, for our last segment today, a funny story about trying to be a gourmet in the backcountry. That's all coming up today on Outdoor Explorer, Alaska Public Media's audio outdoor magazine. Oh, welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. And we are talking about a topic I can't believe we've never talked about in the years we've done the show, which is taxidermy. And maybe it's because of me, because I grew up in Anchorage. And I think of taxidermy as being some guy's musty old thing, you know, but it's really kind of gotten cool again. And it's gotten, you know, reaching into new kinds of people who are doing it and reaching into the media and sort of helping build Alaska mystique nationally. And I've got in the studio somebody who's had a huge part in doing that. Not only a taxidermy guy in Anchorage for the last almost 40 years, but also a TV star. Yeah. Russell Knight is here. He has Knight's Taxidermy in Anchorage. He's also the MC of the World Taxidermy Championships. He was the star of Mounted in Alaska on the History Channel. And still involved in TV and all kinds of stuff. I don't know if you ever knew that taxidermy was going to lead to TV. That probably wasn't what you were thinking of when you got started in this business.
No way would I ever dream it, Charles. And thanks for having me on your show.
Yeah, you bet.
Yeah. Listen, taxidermy, when I started before there were DVDs, videos, or any way to learn taxidermy.
Uh-huh.
And I learned taxidermy. My entire career cost me $12. And I paid $1 a month for mail order lessons.
Uh-huh.
Before there were DVDs, the internet, any way to learn it. You had to go to one of those grungy old taxidermy shops and get somebody to take you under your wing, which is what I did.
And it goes back, you know, I mean, this is a very old art form. I mean, like, I don't know when it started, but there's mounts that are, you know, well over 100 years old that you can see in museums.
Yeah, there actually is like a crocodile that's been mounted that was mounted in the 1600s that they still got. And there's a very old camel with an actual mounted human on the back. That was done from like the 1700s. Yeah, it was kind of creepy. But, you know, taxidermy kind of has been done from the Egyptian days.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, even...
They taxidermied the pharaohs.
Well, they did. I mean, that was kind of a form of taxidermy. And and so taxidermy has been a long history of evolution. And do you know what the word taxidermy means?
I have no idea.
Well, taxidermy, the word taxidermy is a Greek word.
Huh.
And taxi, everybody knows what a taxi is.
Yep.
We have to move about or arrange. So taxi means to move about or arrange, and dermy means skin or layers of skin.
Okay.
So taxidermist means moving about or arranging skin.
Yeah.
Which is what we do.
Uh-huh.
But it's a skill of many, many, many crafts. I mean,
yeah.
You have to know woodworking, you have to know anatomy, you have to know chemicals, balances and pHs, and you know, there's just so much to learn.
Well, here's the thing about it. So a guy comes to you with his trophy. He's killed this animal and it's a lifetime thing. This
mm-hmm.
is something that he's wanted to accomplish his entire life and it's got it and he really wants to have a beautiful mount. You could mess it up, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of pressure involved.
Yeah.
And if you're going to be a taxidermist, you got to learn how to take criticism.
Mm.
And everybody's a critic. And I say that when a hunter takes an animal, he just gave birth to a baby.
Huh.
And you have to handle his animal like a baby because it's now his baby.
Yeah.
He went out in the woods. Not only that, taxidermy is not about hanging a mount on a wall.
Mm-hmm.
It's about reliving the memories that you once had with your partner or person and that animal.
It's kind of bringing it back to life.
Yeah, it's bringing it back to life. And you know, taxidermy is it's not an easy trade to learn.
Oh, I think not, yeah.
No, it takes years and years and years of learning what the client wants to see in his mount.
Mm-hmm.
Listen, anybody can be a mechanic and put a skin on a hide in a form. But to know what a client wants to see at the end of the day, that's really the trick.
Well, you're creating a moment, recreating sort of what he was thinking or what he has in his mind.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get from sort of that image to, like, this, for example, the shape of the animal that you're going to create? You have to kind of be a sculptor, don't you?
You do. You know, fortunately, we do have a taxidermy industry
mm-hmm.
that manufactures mannequins and supplies and things that we can use. But it's kind of limited. You know, you can't buy a, say, for instance, right now I'm working on an African animal, a little honey badger.
Huh.
There's one mannequin in the whole world for that honey badger. Only one, and one size. Well, you know what? Honey badgers come in many different sizes. And so I have to take that one mannequin and make it work, or mm-hmm. I've got to resculpture something from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
So it takes a big skill to... So what happens is a client comes in, gives his vision. What is your vision? What would you like to do with this animal? And then if it's a pretty much a standard mount, you know, there's not a lot to decide. It's going to hang on the wall. It's going to go left, right, straight, mm-hmm. look down, look up. I mean, you know, it's pretty standard. But when it comes to life sizes and certain other things, there's just a litany of poses and
right.
choices. And we take a standard mannequin and we may cut it into 50 pieces. And completely change it into a completely different pose.
Wow.
For like right now, I've got the most expensive animal I've ever had in my shop that was so scary to have in my shop, I had to take it home and put it in my safe at home. It's that valuable.
Wow.
And it's called the Markor, and M-A-R-K-O-R.
And, never heard of it.
Yeah, and it's a mountain goat that lives on the borders of Pakistan and China.
Hmm.
And it cost a couple hundred thousand just to go hunt it.
Wow.
Right. And it's a local resident in town. We have some very good hunters that travel the world. And Anchorage has a very good population of hunters here. You know, this is a hunting community.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so this fellow has traveled the world over to seek these very rare animals. And to me, for him to pick me to mount his animal is like the top thing I can, the greatest thing I can achieve to have a person pick me to do his animal that he just spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to go collect.
Mm-hmm.
So there's great pressure.
Yeah, really.
And to get back to your question is to get it right.
Yeah.
So the way you do that is you consult with the client on as many steps of the method as you can.
Mm-hmm.
So you first collect his vision, then you mock up the mount.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have him sign off on the pose mm-hmm. and what he's wanting to see before the skin ever hits it.
Sort of like your
yeah,
your
we have them sign off. I pretty much on big jobs like this uh-huh. want them to sign off every step of the way.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't get to a problem at the end where he goes, I don't like it. Or I wish you'd turn the head another 20 degrees.
Right.
Or why didn't you make him look down more?
Right, right.
Well, because I can't read your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And a plastic mannequin made of foam is a hard, rigid thing. And to change it is hard.
I bet.
It is.
But you've got the skin, and then I would assume you'd have to kind of adjust the skin in order to get it to fit the pose, and then you have to preserve it, and there's a lot of stages.
Well, the skin's got to be tanned first.
Mm-hmm.
But a true taxidermist adjusts the skin to the mannequin, but he builds the mannequin to fit the skin.
Got ya.
So you can't take away from the skin. You can't mm-hmm. even cut one little dart off.
Mm-hmm.
But the mannequin, the underlayment, the actual body of the animal is what we're building.
Yeah.
And that's a big skill to that. And it takes a bit of effort to do it.
So it's really an artistic skill, and it's something that I think that it's so easy to forget that there's somebody back there doing it, because it's one of these arts where the artist is disappearing, right?
Yeah,
you don't want them to be thinking about you.
No, you don't. It's you want them to be looking at the mountain, pleased and remembering the memories,
mm-hmm.
and you don't even think about the taxidermist.
Yeah, yeah. So I want to learn more about this whole TV aspect, because that's really interesting, and that's become an Alaska thing too. I mean, we did mountains and hunting, but now reality TV as well. Russell Knight is with me. He's with Knight's Taxidermy. You might have seen him on Mounted in Alaska, and he's obviously one of the most experienced and best-known taxidermists in Alaska here on Outdoor Explorer. So how did the TV thing come about?
Well, so I've been in Alaska for about 35 years mm-hmm. in the same location, and one day we got a phone call from Hollywood, and it was a little 24-year-old scout from Hollywood, and she says I was number 83. I said, what do you mean, number 83? She says, well, I've talked to 83 taxidermists, and when I get to 100, if I don't find any talent, this idea's going away.
Right.
Well, so I gave her what I call the old Russell razzle-dazzle
right,
on the phone.
Right,
and impressed her with as much stuff as I could.
You know, Alaska patter always helps, right?
Yeah.
We know how to play
yep,
that.
Yeah, I gave her the razzle-dazzle. The next thing you know, I had a fella here within a week. Big tall guy, about 6'5", named Ian, and he was the greatest guy. And we spent a week filming smash scenes, meaning like I would put a fake set of sheep horns on an old mount I had and act like I'm stepping off the ladder and the thing would fall and hit the floor. So we tore stuff up for a week.
What is this showing, like, what could go wrong?
Yeah, like, grab that sheep off the wall. Well, see, when you do a TV show, you got to have risk and reward.
Right.
And it's all about what's the risk, what's the reward, and what could go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you start watching reality TV shows, there's risk and reward in every one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were just trying to show the risk and reward. And this guy was a young fella in the trade, and in the filming what's known as a sizzle. This is called a sizzle, a 3 to 5 minute little tape of what could happen.
Oh, it's sort of just selling.
So they came up and did what's called a sizzle. Took a week, and we just played and had fun.
Was it really fun?
It was really fun. And so the next thing I know, I get a call from this Hollywood producer. He says, "Oh, great! You know, guess what? History Channel's really, really interested, but we got one obstacle." I go, what's that? He goes, well, History Channel's decided to make you compete against another shop. And whoever does the best pilot episode wins series. So there was a taxidermy shop out of Texas.
Oh, they don't know
named Blanco Taxidermy in Blanco, Texas. And they did an episode. And we did an episode. And then they do studies in back in New York City. They bring in people.
See how people like it.
And they see how people like it. And they do a case study and they vote on the lead characters and the content of the show and things like that. And so fortunately for us, plus Alaska's its own character.
Absolutely.
We knew we were going to beat Texas because we're twice as big.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So so at any rate, Knight's Taxidermy in Alaska won.
Right.
And the next thing you know, we had they ordered a huge number of episodes, which was 16 episodes, which is a giant order. And everybody was shocked, and they were half-hour episodes. And we started filming in January, and we finished on May 5th.
Does it, like, totally take over your life? I mean, they shut down the business and just do the TV show?
Well, it pretty much took over my whole life. But, you know, I have a large studio. I mean, we do have 20 employees, mm-hmm. and, you know, it's about an 8,500-square-foot shop. So when you pick a TV show, you generally have 6 to 8 characters on the show, which is mm-hmm. what we had. And the rest of the staff, unfortunately, were just seen in passing, and they weren't a character.
Right.
So they were the ones responsible. Yeah. So what happened was it did pretty much shut my shop down, but they gave me a parking lot attendant who could walk my clients in because we had a big sign up that said live camera action. And it would scare my clients away. So when you walked up to the shop, big sign says live action filming. And my clients were driving away.
Yeah.
And so what was happening, so they put an attendant in the parking lot to park the people and walk them in through the side door of the building, whatever we weren't filming in at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically what happened was, is I viewed it as a contract for 3 months of taxidermy, which actually turned into like 4 or 5. And it was really great for us. I wouldn't say we made a lot of money,
mm-hmm.
but they paid us enough money to cover all of our expenses for those 3 to 4 months.
Not bad advertising.
No. And then, you know, I figure it was probably $5 to $10 million worth of advertising.
Yeah, really.
And then I got to travel all over the country speaking in radio shows like this.
Oh,
and,
how cool.
And doing TV shows and, you know, little network things. Uh-huh. And it was just so much fun. And then when our show aired, they hired out Blues Central over there, Frank.
Frank Dahl's place.
Dahl's place, and because that was my favorite bar.
Uh-huh.
And they piped in, put a giant 60-inch screen in there, and they let me invite all my friends.
Uh-huh.
And then it aired back in New York City at like 6 p.m. And they catered the place, brought in all his food. I got to bring all my friends down. They brought in my brother from Texas, and we just had a ball.
I bet.
Watching it live.
And did you like the show, the way it came out?
I did. But, you know, I wouldn't do I got to say, I probably didn't get the second season because I just would not. I want it to be a happy show and a fun show. And
a lot of these shows, people are just screaming at each other all the time.
Yeah, and they were trying to make me be like the big, bad, mean Paul, right? And I didn't want to do that. So we made it into a funny show. And if you watch our episodes, it's not too serious. It's all about fun.
Yeah.
And you know, they'd come up and say, hey, go over there and smash this behind that guy and then chew him out. And I'd go, well, what did he do? They said, well, we don't know what he did. You just need to get over there and blah, blah, blah. And I go, there's no way. We'll turn that into a learning situation. Uh-huh. We'll go over there and create. And so my whole deal was to turn it into a learning situation because I'm not really a screamer unless you really do get under my skin.
So there's a lot of make-believe.
So what happened was is I wrote like 50 show episodes. There's an A and a B story in every show.
Right. So there's got to be a
plot. And sometimes a C.
Yeah.
So I would write like a show, like one of my favorite show was, I'm going to call it The Horse's Butt. Or you could use, I use another word.
Uh-huh.
But, and it was about this lady had a horse tail and she just wanted it put on a board.
Uh-huh.
But then I said, well, it needs a butt on it, a rear end. So we went down and I just made this stuff up.
Uh-huh.
And I'd pitch these like, you know, 200 word paragraphs to Hollywood, and out of like 100 that I pitched, they'd pick 50 or 60. Right? And so I wrote basically every episode because they had no idea what to talk about.
Right.
Or what
they don't know anything about taxidermy.
They don't know anything about taxidermy. But what they'd try to do is gin the thing up, you know, like, why don't you go over and glue this stuff on his table and y'all have a fight about this and that? You know, and like, we're here about taxidermy, the client.
Mm-hmm.
Making ourselves look like heroes. And if you're not going to make us look like a hero, you're going to make us look like a zero. That was my whole thing.
Yeah, you don't want to have a bogus thing that makes you look like an idiot.
No, and we have to have, and everything has to be true. We don't want to be, because what happened was we did a polar bear that came out of a lodge up off the Parks Highway. And we put this face on this polar bear. And then on the TV show, we put it back in the restaurant. Well, all these people go to the restaurant to see the polar bear.
Right.
But the problem was the owner of the polar bear, once we'd restored it from him, it came out so nice, he claimed it back from the restaurant and took it to his house. And all these people started going to the restaurant looking for the polar bear.
Right, right.
So we learned a lesson there because, you know, people actually do believe everything you tell them on TV.
Yeah, that's strange, huh?
Yeah. And we tried to make it so that it was true.
Yeah.
But it was more fun than a barrel of monkeys.
Yeah.
And we almost made it back.
I see your personality is probably what made it a great show.
Well, it was fun.
Yeah.
I mean, we wanted to have fun with it. No sense in being, you know, having a hard time about anything. Mm-hmm. You know, life's short. Let's make it fun.
Absolutely. So now you have taken this a little bit farther in terms of you're still doing taxidermy. Of course, that's your business. Mm-hmm. But then you're also in the entertainment business.
Yeah, well, I've been trying to help get TV shows going. And I was lucky to meet a fellow out of D'Lo, Mississippi, where I own a little piece of land down there. He was the mayor, and he just would not shut up. He could tell an honest joke, a clean joke, consecutively for an hour. And you would laugh without any bad words or anything.
That's
anyway,
pretty impressive,
I was impressed. And so one day I called up this guy I was working with. I was working with American Chainsaw Entertainment, who we were doing a show called Alaska Moose Men up here. Mm-hmm. And we did a pilot, but it didn't take off. And I called him up and said, hey, I know this mayor. I know this show. And I happen to know another network's looking at a mayor show because the mayor of Whittier had called me up, Lester Lunsford, and told me they were looking. But then Lester got recalled. and it didn't work out, so I called the network.
They don't
pitched
keep their mayors long in Whittier.
I pitched it to American Chainsaw Entertainment, and the next thing you know, I called it Mr. Mayor, and it came out Small Town Big Mayor, and it's on Up TV, and they just did 8 episodes.
That's cool.
And so we're so happy because Mississippi, my home state, is getting a little bit of credit. And it's about this mayor who the town used to be 10 or 15,000 people. They're down to 400 people. And he's trying to rebuild his town. So
that sounds great.
Yeah. So taxidermy has led me into TV, into speaking, into all kinds of things. It's been a wonderful career for
me. It sounds fabulous. So my guest is Russell Knight from Knight's Taxidermy. And as you've heard, he's done all this amazing stuff. And he's also MC of the World Taxidermy Championships. One of the things I want to get into, Russell, while I got you here, a lot of our listeners are hunters and outdoorsmen, and they might, maybe they've never used a taxidermist. Maybe that's something they would consider.
Mm-hmm.
What do you need to know if you are going to, if that's your goal and you're in the field?
Well, I mean, if you're going hunting, I always say you need to visit your taxidermist before you go.
Oh, okay.
You don't need to wait until after because there's so many mistakes that can be made in the field.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a lot of hunters, and this isn't a slam, but they're handicapped in a way that they don't understand skinning and fleshing,
mm-hmm.
right? And what they need to do is come out to the shop. I would say come to Knight's Taxidermy, but go to any taxidermist that you know and visit them first and tell them, listen, I'm going to hunt caribou. I want to make sure I bring it back in a way I don't spoil it mm-hmm. and I don't cut it wrong. And, you know, what do I need to do? And so, you know, we generally love to have people come down to the shop, go through the studio, ask questions, and then we let them go to the skinning room and stand there and watch all of our skinners work.
Hmm.
We'll even let them try to turn something if they show proficiency. You know, so they really need to talk to their taxidermist. Their taxidermist needs to become their best friend before they go.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what are some of the, like, worst mistakes that people make?
The worst mistake is people cut the animal short. Now, what that means is the 90% of our mounts are shoulder mounts, mounts that hang on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll cut them on the neck, walk in and say, I'd like a shoulder mount.
Well, there's no
shoulder.
Well,
I go, there's no shoulder, right? Or, you know, so, or they'll cut plenty of skin on the back, but then they high center it in the front because they let their knife walk. Mm-hmm. They don't cut it in the right place. They don't understand. So what I tell everybody is go to the middle of the animal's belly and make a complete circle first, all the way around it. That establishes the length of the cape,
mm-hmm.
right? Before you start cutting up the back of the neck. Mm-hmm. Just that cures 99% of the problem if you'll just make a complete circle around the animal before you start skinning.
Got it. Yeah.
Right. And that solves the problem because they don't understand. So if they'll visit their taxidermist, he'll square you away. Yeah.
What are the most difficult of Alaska animals to do taxidermy? Is it like bears or is it?
Well, I would say bears are probably pretty real difficult. Mm-hmm. They're probably the most difficult for me. And it's because of the time of years bears are killed and hunted. There's a spring and a fall.
Mm-hmm.
In the spring, the bear has a very thick root, and the root is rooted into the skin and does not come out. But the bear has another problem called rubbing. He can rub the hair off and have like a buffed area that, you know, he looks like somebody's got clippers after him, right?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And so the hair won't fall out, but it's been rubbed off by the bear rubbing his butt, so rubbing his head on a tree, going up against a post. That's what they do. It's mm-hmm. they're coming out of a deep winter, thick fur. They got to get that fur off
mm-hmm.
so they can rub. The problem with a fall bear, which causes us the most problem, is that a fall bear, so a spring bear, when he comes out of the den, he's 25% less in size than he was when he went in the fall. Well, now he's eaten all summer, he's gained back 25%, and his skin is very thin now. And the root bulb is actually in the fat. So if you cut too deep, you can cut the hair roots out, and the hair can fall out.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and so if you pull on it with the wrong pair of tongs, or you grab it with your... So a fall bear is much more difficult to get mounted.
Wow.
In the terms of my job.
Mm-hmm.
And most clients don't understand that, but the hair, you just look at it and it falls out.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's in a sheath that is not anchored now.
Just because this bear is puffed up with all
the fat. Because his skin is so fat.
Yeah.
His skin has gotten down so thin that the root bulb is exposed on the fat side.
Yeah.
Right? And so people don't realize that's the problem, but that's the problem.
So much art and craft involved in this. It's really amazing how long it must take to learn to get really good at it.
It generally takes about 4 years for a guy to become a competent taxidermist working for me.
Mm-hmm.
But because of all the different animals and species that we do from all over the world, you know, it takes many years of, like, I do all this African, and I mainly do all the African myself. So on one side, they do all the Fords and Chevys, and on my side, I do the Maseratis and the Ferraris, right?
Well, I don't want to let you go without telling me about competitive taxidermy. You're MC of the World Taxidermy Championship. I didn't even know you could compete. I mean, I guess you could compete at anything, but I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah, competitive taxidermy is a big deal, and it's also a moneymaker for those that can get dialed in on it.
Mm-hmm.
So people come from all over the world. There's a magazine called Breakthrough taxidermy magazine that hosts the World Taxidermy Competition. And taxidermists compete from all over the world for the best white-tailed deer, the best life-size mount, the best recreated. So the biggest winner last year was a lady named Carolyn Dolny Brake. No, Carolyn Brake Dolny was her name. And she won with a recreated red panda. And it wasn't even the real animal. It looked real, but it was made from all parts of other animals.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, it was amazing. That's what I'm saying. It was amazing. Yeah. And this gal won it. And so lately, we've seen this trend in the last, say, I'd say 7 or 8 years since TV, taxidermy's gotten on TV. There's been several shows, things like that. People are no longer scared to walk into a taxidermy shop. And think it's a grungy old place.
Right.
So,
it's
you know,
back. Yeah.
And, you know, and I preach to the to every taxidermist I talk to that you have to have a woman-friendly shop. A lady has to be able to walk in your shop and not be grossed out by the smell or odor or anything like that.
Right. Well, a lot of women are hunting. We've got plenty of them on the show, yeah.
Right. And so nowadays, you know, ladies and children are the future of taxidermy, right? Because, you know, the ladies... Well, listen, even since when I was a kid in a taxidermy shop, there's been gals around, but they were helpers. They were they never stepped up, and nowadays they are kicking butt in all these competitions and they're making these guys look bad. So I'm so happy for them.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad these ladies are out there and you know, and I'm kind of like this old fella sitting around and I'm here to help anybody.
That's cool.
And there's no secrets. I've got no secrets anymore and I'll tell anybody anything.
Great. Well, and that's a perfect segue because our next interview is with a young female taxidermist here in Anchorage who's doing all kinds of new different things, creating animals that never existed and everything else. So stick with us on the show. You're going to hear about that. But I want to thank Russell Knight, who's been with me. He's got Knight's Taxidermy. Sounds like a great place to go if you're looking for a taxidermist or if you just want to watch TV. You can do that for you, too. Thanks so much for being here, Russell.
Thanks for having me, Charles. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much.
Stick with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Well, I'm learning so much about taxidermy today on Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and we have been digging into this topic that I admit I knew next to nothing about. And finding, and now I have a guest with me who is kind of the next generation. And you know, taxidermy is no longer all about you know, stinky old guys in a stinky old shop. Sam Huckstep has got Naturally Wild Taxidermy, and she's doing some really creative stuff, and it sounds like your business has really taken off.
Absolutely. Yeah, it has been exploding ever since I opened my doors.
That's so cool. So tell me, how did you get interested in this? I mean, it seems like something that is kind of way off what people are thinking about.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's kind of a roundabout story that I started. I was really interested in looking at the animals and watching the animals, studying what they do, what they eat, you know, and how they move from a very young age. So
And you're kind of from a rural area.
Very, yeah.
Back in upstate New York, I think you said.
Definitely,
yeah.
Yep. So, you know, even growing up in upstate, I had deer in my backyard all the time where I was watching them, and my dad was very interested in hunting as well, so I started going to hunting camps, and it was kind of funny because one of my first memories that I have is he brought me to this hunting camp, and he brought me out hunting, and I had the whole gear on, all the camouflage and whatnot, and I was up in my tree stand, and I came back empty-handed. And he goes, oh, she was probably just watching the animals and seeing what they're doing, and it's the truth. I really was. You know, I saw the deer coming in, and as I got more into hunting and, you know, the actual aspect of going out and harvesting your animal, I really wanted to be able to use that whole animal to the fullest. So that's where I started, you know, I started saving squirrel tails and figuring out how to preserve them and turkey tails and fanning them out.
So it's partly just this fascination and love for nature and for the animals, which I think non-hunters sometimes don't understand. It's not just about the hunting. It's about, like, the love for the creature.
That is exactly it. Yeah. I really want to be able to bring that animal back to life, essentially. And hunting for a lot of people is like a spiritual thing, you know. They put so much time and effort into harvesting that animal. And I want to be able to bring that memory to them so that they can have it for a lifetime. And it's a way that it can be passed down. You know, mm-hmm. my first experiences in my dad's house and my mom, my parents, I remember deer heads on the wall. And mm-hmm. I remember the stories behind those and how much effort it was to go get them. And it's just, you know, it's a way that it can be passed down and
So that inspiration for you came very early. So what was the next step after you start gathering up your squirrel tails and stuff?
So after that, you know, I had been more interested in it and I wanted to be able to preserve everything. So I moved to Alaska for adventure primarily. Uh-huh. And I moved to a very rural location in Eagle River. I'm up in the mountains and I always have grizzly bears walking through and moose. And you know, one of the days I was just like, I think this is it. You know, Alaska's very accepting of taxidermy, mm-hmm. and just about every Alaskan home, you know, you have deer head or, you know, moose heads on the wall, right. and caribou and grizzly bears life size and all sorts of crazy stuff. So I decided I was going to put myself through taxidermy school. And I had been working up here as a case manager and also as an animal control officer, saving up money, getting ready to quit everything and start up full time. Finally, when I felt that I was able to quit, you know, financially stable, and I applied for a $40,000 loan, and I bought equipment, and I put myself through taxidermy school.
So taxidermy school is something I've never heard of.
Yes.
Where do you go for that? I mean, what is it? Was it involved?
There's a lot of different schools around. There's none in Alaska, unfortunately, which is a bummer. But I went to Artistic School of Taxidermy in Idaho. And it was a fantastic experience. I really learned everything from the ground up on uh-huh. how to preserve the animal, or first how to skin out the animal, how to preserve the animal, and then go into the actual mounting of the animal, where you're learning how to drape the hides over forms and carve those forms so that they look, you know, anatomically correct. And then from there, you know, you learn your clay work and where to put the clay under the eyes and over the eyes creases and the eyelids.
So now you're talking about something I don't know anything about.
Sure.
And so it's okay. tell me a little bit about that artistic process and how mm-hmm. you're sort of recreating the animal's face. I mean, that's amazing.
I use a ton of reference pictures. Mm-hmm. And when hunters can provide me pictures of the animals that they harvested, that is just phenomenal for me, because I'm looking at the way the eye and the mouth and the nose all drape and form around what used to be the structure of the animal, the bone structure, the muscle structure. And I have to recreate that, because in taxidermy, all we're using is the skin. And so whatever you take out from underneath that skin, you have to put back for it right. to look, you know, right.
Right.
So I use clays and forms, molds, castings, which are polyurethane forms now. Mm-hmm. And that's actually what I drape the hides over. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's all sorts of tucking tools that you do to make that skin hold and stay in the correct areas where it has to be.
Wow. So did you have a lot of artistic talent, or was art a big part of your life before you got into this? Because it seems to me, as I'm hearing about it, it sounds a bit like sculpture, a bit by like ceramics, a bit by like sewing, a lot of things that really require a lot of sort of spatial relations and ability to make your hands do what your eyes are asking them to do.
Absolutely. You have to really be a jack of all trades in taxidermy. And when I was younger, I kind of floated around in different directions. You know, my dad was a carpenter, so I learned woodworking and everything mm-hmm. from there. And I was really interested in that. But my mom, she did a lot of sewing. My grandmother had a seamstress business. And so I learned sewing with my mom and my grandmother. And all of these things kind of tied together and warped into taxidermy for me. I was very into art, and I liked drawing, although I wasn't very good at it. I was into wood burning and all of these things, but I always had the primary focus of animals.
Uh-huh.
No matter what I was doing, it always had to do something with, you know, what the animals were doing, what they were looking like, and how I could make that happen either on paper or on wood. And then taxidermy came. The whole animal, you know, just happened to be with the skin.
Yeah, yeah. Do you feel like you are pioneering as a female in this business? I mean, because traditionally we think of hunting and fishing and, you know, sort of the, you know, rod and bullet, all this stuff, and then taxidermy being like the extreme of that, right? Of being all very masculine. But that's really not true that much anymore in a lot of these areas.
That's correct. Yeah.
But are there? It sounds like there's sort of a lot more women getting into this, and maybe you're sort of on the leading edge of that.
Yeah, there definitely are. You know, there has been women in taxidermy for a long time now. It wasn't really accepted, I don't think, until more recently. And now, even at the taxidermy school that I went to, there were several women that were coming through either after me or before me to learn the techniques and everything that they needed to do to open their own business. And even in Alaska here, you know, we have several really good female taxidermists around the area. And it is being very much more accepted.
Yeah, yeah. And it sounds like a business where there's a lot of need. I mean, it's not like you're coming into something and having trouble drumming up people to come to you.
Definitely, yeah. In Alaska especially, you know, everybody wants to preserve that memory and they want to have that animal. I actually have jobs lined up right now where the people, my customers, they don't hunt. I have two that really, they don't have an interest in hunting. They don't want to hunt, but yet they want that animal on the wall.
Huh.
To have their home more Alaskan and have that feel.
Uh-huh.
So, you know.
And you don't want to just go to a garage sale.
Exactly, yeah. Well, they want to still be able to tell me, you know, what the look that they're looking for is. Mm-hmm. And I can give that to them.
So where does the animal come from that you're going to be doing for them?
Other hunters. Okay. So in Alaska, you can purchase a fur buyer's license. Uh-huh. And I would go to other hunters, which I love, because if they weren't going to use it, I can use it for somebody else that's going
to
really appreciate it.
Why let it go to waste? Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. Uh-huh. So you can still use that whole thing.
Uh-huh. What kinds of things are happening that are different or new, that are not just sort of the traditional thing that we all would have been familiar with, you know,
sure.
Years
there
ago?
Are always new techniques coming out. And that's one of the things that I really like. I love learning new techniques. That's why I went to the taxidermy school, and I will be going to another one. Probably next year, to learn some more techniques on things that are up and coming. With the forms that I was talking about, you know, they started out with just stuffing animals with rags, you know, way back when taxidermy was first starting up. But now we have sculptors that are hired by the taxidermy companies, the big supply companies that me and other taxidermists order from. And the sculptors are now really much more focused on the anatomy of the animals and where that muscle structure should be and you know, how that animal should look if it's in a pouncing position or if it's outreaching like a lynx or something.
Uh-huh.
So that's a really big deal, which helps us out a lot. And then, you know, different clays are coming out, different epoxies, and figuring out how we can use those items to make our animals look more lifelike when we're mounting them. That's all, you know, brand new up and coming stuff. And, you know, every day I'm learning something new. I go online, there's taxidermy forums and stuff like that you can learn a lot from.
Uh-huh. So it sounds like you're working with some really exotic materials and kind of challenging materials. Like you've got this skin that, like, the hair could fall out of it or all kinds of things could happen to it.
Definitely. Taking care of the animal is number one, you know, and it starts in the field from when that hunter is harvesting that animal. If they wait too long to get it to me, you know, and it's not in a freezer or it's not properly salted, that hair can fall out. Once it's in my shop and under my hands, I have to be extremely careful because I need to get it prepped, which is taking the fat off and fleshing it is what we call, and then I send it off to the tannery, who tans it and really preserves that hide so that I can use it later on, and I have more time to work with it, and the hair doesn't fall out, which we call slip. And then, you know, from there's different aspects where I have to really watch my time, because those new materials, some of them, they can harden really fast and you're not able to put the detail in that you wanted to put in. And you can't go back, you know? Uh-huh,
right. If you mess it up, you're really...
It's done, yeah.
So there must be a business in town that tans these hides for you?
There are several. And, you know, some taxidermists, they can tan their own stuff. I do have an auto tanner, which I do some tanning. However, I prefer to send my jobs out. And I use a tannery in Soldotna for the main vast majority of my work. And they've been great. They use different chemicals. And
that's like an age-old thing from, you know, from the Stone Age.
It is, yeah. But, you know, even with tanning, there's new things up and coming, different chemicals that they're using and different ways to tumble. But for the most part, it's the same ideas. Everybody, even taxidermy tanneries, they all have the same ideas on what used to be going on. It's just how to implement new ways to make it look better.
Yeah, yeah. It's Outdoor Explorer. We're talking about taxidermy, and Sam Huckstep has Naturally Wild Taxidermy. My name is Charles Wolfworth, and she is as you can probably hear from her voice, a young woman who is like coming into this field and sounds like having a really good time of it. A field that, you know, might have been thought of as not being the domain of the young or of females or sort of creative types, but it really is.
Absolutely.
Is kind of cool. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So in this article that in the ADN, which we'll link at outdoorexplorer.org by Tegan Hanlon, she discusses a little bit of people doing, like creating animals that never existed and doing other kind of things. I mean, is there sort of a hipster part of this whole thing where people are doing sort of weird new stuff?
There definitely is, and it's called rogue taxidermy, and it's definitely a new up-and-coming thing. I haven't seen too much of it in Alaska. I was super impressed to see that there is a new up-and-coming rogue taxidermist here. A lot of times, you know, in the lower 48, it was, I think it was more popular down there early back, but Alaska seems to be a little bit behind times with everything. But, you know,
right.
It's still really neat, you know, and they can really take different bits and pieces of animals and put them together to create a whole new animal or a mythological creature type animal. So,
Yeah, well, I was kind of wondering when I saw that if they were like kind of being ironic or if they were just being creative or where they were coming from with that.
You know, it all boils down to it's an art form, you know, and there's different kinds of art out there. You know, some are painters and some people paint with clays, you know. There's all sorts of different things going on, and taxidermy is no different, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. So what you're doing is you're trying to make the animal look as much like it really looked as you can.
My preference is definitely
just
the traditional taxidermy.
Yeah.
I really enjoy looking at a bear outside of my window, for instance, and then being able to look at my customer's bear and be like, yeah, that's definitely a bear.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, I have the eyes right. And that pose is perfect, you know. So.
Are you trying to get a certain mood of the animal and like what it's sort of, I don't know if thinking, we don't know what animals think, but sort of what it was happening at that particular moment?
Absolutely. And I always ask my customers their story. You know, if they tell me, oh my gosh, that bear was charging out of the woods and it was coming right at me, you know, I'm going to be, oh, so do you want it to look semi-aggressive? And do you want it to have, you know, creases in the mouth so that it looks like it's aggressive, you know? And if they say yes, then I can go forward with that and I can make the ears in a more aggressive position, which would be more back. And, you know, me working at animal control in the past, I was really able to see how animals respond in different manners. And I'm able to bring some of that into my work because if I see, you know, if there's a dog, you know, a dog's mean because it's growling at you when its teeth are out, you know, bear showing teeth and its ears are back and it's all puffed up. So I can do the same thing with a bear.
Yeah.
And, you know, bring that grizzly bear really to life by making it look super aggressive. Now, if they say they want it to look like Winnie the Pooh, I can make its eyes, you know, more, you know, rounded out and happy looking, you know.
So it sounds like you have always been a real animal lover and you worked at animal control. That seems like it might be a really sad place for an animal lover to work.
It's kind of tough, yeah.
But,
you know, taxidermy is no different. You know, I love the animals and I still would hunt if I had the time. It's just, like I was saying, it's more of a spiritual thing for that. But yeah, both sides of thing, it's kind of the circle of life, you know?
Yeah.
And everything has an end and I can display that end. Some people put pictures on the wall and I can put the whole animal on the wall.
Yeah, pretty cool. So you're not hunting anymore?
I'm not hunting anymore.
Because you're just too busy?
That is the main reason. Yeah. Sometimes I'm working 12, 14 hours a day in the shop. So,
wow.
And obviously hunting season is my busiest time.
Right. But despite all those hours, it's still fun.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Well, thanks so much for being here. I really enjoyed learning about this.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
Yeah, it's been Sam Huckstep from Naturally Wild Taxidermy on Outdoor Explorer. Please stick with us. For this next segment, something a bit different. We're going back to the stage at the 49th State Brewing Company in downtown Anchorage, where Alaska Trails presents its periodic Trail Tales show. It's an event where outdoor folks get up to tell their own stories of adventure and mishaps on the trail, and you can find out more about it at outdoorexplorer.org. The story we're going to hear now is from Jessica Zelag, who shared her experiences about trying to be a gourmet in the backcountry and the setbacks that sometimes come along with those ambitions.
I'm going to grab this. I'm from the East Coast, so I talk with my hands and do this a lot. Also, I'm pregnant and forget things and need my notes, so bear with me. So the Bath Lakes High Route, it's a backcountry route in the Glacier National Forest to the North Cascades National Park. No one knows where this is. It's a really just obtuse backcountry trail. And what I want to share with you guys is not so much the story of what happened on our backpack and how beautiful it was and the lakes that we swim and that's all there and you can read about it and I have photos and all, but more or less I want to get to the food that we ate and planned to eat, the drinks that we carefully crafted and had our little Nalgene's, and then how it all just went terribly wrong. So, my name's Jessica, and I lived in Seattle for 12 years and moved up to Alaska last year, mainly just to have a new playground. I was getting to the point with me and my friends that we were finding the most obscure places that we could find in the North Cascades that no one had been to in the last few years just to get that really rural, rugged, natural experience. And now I live in Girdwood, and I can just walk outside, and there's a moose, and that experience happens right away. But so when I moved to Seattle, though, 12 years ago, I really had no experience backpacking. I had car camped as a kid and, maybe had like one of those huge sleeping bags and had spent the night out someplace kind of far from the car, but never really backpacked. My husband and I fell in with a friend who was from the Midwest, and he hadn't seen mountains either growing up. And so we started really, really small. You know, one year we had a backpack. Like the first annual backpack, we called it, and we spent two nights outside in the wild, and it was crazy, and we fell in love with it. And this year, we just went on our 10th annual backpack. We went to Wrangell-St. Elias National Park. We did a seven-night, eight-day trip with a bush plane, and we've progressed as far as what we do. If anything, we're always carrying our crampons, if not pickets and ropes and harnesses. We've got all the gear. And so as our difficulty in our backpacks increased, so did our number of friends willing to go with us decrease. But our elaborate meal planning just went through the roof. So we figured if we're going out there on these rugged, gnarly hikes, we're going over glaciers, we're setting pickets to cross over crevasses, we should have a signature cocktail when we get to our camp. They're very nice things. We needed the creature comforts. Meanwhile, going light is a big thing, and so we're dropping gear where we can, and like the little foil on the toothpaste thing you're taking off ahead of time. But some of our so just to share with you some of our meals though, signature meals, so chicken and dumplings, things that are non-perishable really was what we started to go big on. So chicken and dumplings with like the canned chicken and bisquick, gnocchi with butter packets and bacon bits, very delicious. Let's see what else. Brought the brats, the pre-cooked brats. But then we got a little more elaborate. We've done hamburgers in the backcountry, like raw meat. We've brought in with like a condiment bar and pickles, and it like people walk by and they're like, chicken parmesan, like really fried, like battered chicken and fried it with an egg that we brought in. So it's just gotten a little ridiculous with the food. Drinks, some of our favorites, Cadillac margaritas, whiskey gingers with like cans of ginger ale, Manhattans, and one of the best ones is whiskey sours with like a 2 pound lime bat, 2 pounds of limes on like day six. We like this. This is what we do. So like the food was never a question of are we dropping or like the whiskey, we got to have that. So it's year nine. This is the ninth year with the backpack, so this is 2 years ago. We're doing the Bath Lakes High Route. The only route description you're going to find of this is in a 1965 book by Crowder and Tabor, if anyone's ever read this, called roots in rocks. So we've got like photocopies of this thing, and we never saw a human footprint. As far as we know, it had been like 3 years since anyone had been out. What's interesting about it is you come, if anyone knows that area, it's kind of like the Mountain Loop Highway, and then you come out onto the PCT, and you're in Stehekin, and there's a bakery with like cinnamon buns and everything. But we hadn't seen people for days, mind you. Like, we, you know, you're way up there. So we start off on this trip. So day one, and then we'll get to day two, and so where everything goes wrong. But so day one is just gnarly. So it's like 7,000 feet, 10 miles, only about 4.5 miles is on a trail. So, and it's hot, it's like 90 degrees, and there's some bugs in the parking lot, but you know, not a lot. And we've got full bags going. Like, we've got all our glacier gear, all our climbing stuff, and then tons of food and tons of booze. So we're looking at like 60, 65 pound bags for a 4-night backpack. Like, we're not climbing Denali. We're not doing anything. We're just going on a backpack. But anyway, so we're like ready to go. And I've got, you know, there's three guys and me, and I've got like the heaviest bag, and I'm like, I can totally do this, you know. So our meal for this trip, my meal, ramen with 6 pounds of slow-cooked ginger pork. Hard-boiled eggs, scallions, and limes, of course. We also had a footlong hot dog night, so like the baseball footlongs with, like, we had a bag of buns attached to the outside, like next to the crampons, just kind of there with all the condiments and pickles and stuff. Spaghetti and meatball night. You know those pre-made garlic breads that you get with like the weird butter, and like two of those attached. It's like picket garlic bread. And then a good one for the last night, because, you know, we didn't want to carry that much, crispy avocado melt, which is tortillas, avocado, sun-dried tomatoes, Manchego cheese, and potato chips. And you, like, melt that all up. It's delicious. Drinks, Cadillac margaritas, that's a good one. Orange noon with vanilla vodka. I know we're in a bar or in a restaurant, but, like, imagine you're in the backcountry. Like, this stuff's delicious. Gin and snonics. So cans of tonic, and you add snow, and it becomes a snonic, get it? Yeah, that one's mine. And then old fashions, because you need all that fruit. So my bag alone, I had 6 pounds of meat, 4 pounds of liquor, 2 pounds of just accoutrements that would go with the ramen, and that's just for the first night of food. And then all of our other gear and snacks and stuff along the way. So anyways, and now I'm going to tell you, this all goes wrong. So it's day one. We do that 7,000 feet, 10 miles. It's a lot of bushwhacking. The bugs just get worse and worse. And I've never seen bugs like this. I've brought a head net on a bunch of backpacks thinking that it would be bad. And after years, I started to drop it because they're never actually that bad. This was the year not to do that. We had the trifecta of mosquitoes biting black flies and horse flies. And we finally get to our camp, and we're just, you know, it's been 90 degrees, we're exhausted. And, you know, we plan for this, but we do a lot of backpacks, but this is the backpack, this is the 9th annual backpack, and it's just going all so wrong. And we have, you know, 4 more days of uncharted territory, side-hilling, before we even get close to safety again. So we're kind of hemming and hawing, and we're like, God, like, should we just bag it? Like, should we just get out of here and do something else? And we start breaking into the whiskey, and I really played up that, like, I'm the girl, and my bag's really heavy, you guys. And I am a little bit slower than the guys. They're, like, 6 feet tall. So I convinced them that we have to have not only my meal that night, but we also have to have my signature cocktail. And so we, you know, we get through the night. You know, the bugs, you can't, like, eat anything without them getting into your face and your nose and all this stuff. And so it's just kind of not what you picture for this trip. And we, like, go to bed kind of, you know, sad and depressed. And the next day we wake up and we're like, I guess we're going to do it. So we get up and we share, like, this big tent. It's glorious, you know. The Big Agnes tent. You can fit 4 people in that. But you have to, like, dive out before the bugs get in. And I'm sitting in the tent with all the soft things, afraid to leave because there's bugs and there's unknown terrain, and I don't want to do it. So my friends are helpful in kind of bringing over the stuff, and I'm like reaching out of the tent and trying to pack, and finally it's like, you gotta get out of the tent, you gotta go. And so we leave kind of in a rush, and we spend the next day, it gets like slowly better. The bugs start to die down, the side hilling's not as bad as we thought. We get off some of the glaciers, so it's like more kind of tundra rambling, you know, there's really beautiful moments. And we get to camp on the second night, and we unpack our bags, and I don't have the stove. I totally left it. Well, okay, I didn't leave it. I just completely forgot. I get to camp, and there's no stove, and we have hot dog night coming, and like this is all the stuff that we have no other food other than like perishable things that need to be heated up. So we do have a jet boil on us. And we're like, okay, this is, and we have like one little canister of fuel. So we're like, okay, we can get through the next three nights, no problem. Jet boils don't thread, it didn't thread through the canister the right way. We had to like bungee cord up this thing. We survived. But I wanted to share with you guys my top seven lessons learned about gourmet eating in the backcountry. So number one is always anticipate bugs. We had a half of a thing of bug spray on us. And they were so bad. That's part of the reason we wanted to bail, was because we had nothing to protect us against the army that was sucking our blood and eating our skin. But always anticipate bugs. Two, really think carefully about who carries essential gear. Not the ice screw or, you know, the rope, but who's got the stove and the water filter, because this will become important. And I have a history of losing things. My friends knew this, yet they gave me the stove. And they never will again. Three is carry backup fire making materials. So this was a jet boil. It failed on us. Lighters, flints. Leah Slumman's actually told me a story today about how they've used yak dung in a pinch that did not work either, but you can try. You can try. You know how you're going to cook your food, especially if you have raw meat on you. Number four, not everyone can do this one, but bring engineers. So two out of the four were engineers. Yes, you guys are so handy. You're so handy. And especially if you give them a bungee and some rocks and you're like, hot dog night. And here's a cocktail, please fix this. So bring an engineer and bungees. Number five is possibly evaluate your booze. Either go down or go big. You know, if you're not gonna cut, don't cut the booze in your weight. Number six is evaluate your meals. So if you go big on the booze, maybe cut back on, you know, there's freeze dried. That's lovely. There's easier things. Maybe not every meal has to be gourmet on a really rugged backpack. And then number seven, my last of my seven lessons learned, is that good friends that you play with in the outdoors are invaluable. Good friends that stay your friend after you mess up in the outdoors are even more invaluable. And surely. Thank you.
That was Jessica Zelag, recorded at Trail Tales, Alaska Trails event that they hold in Anchorage. And you can find out more about that by linking through outdoorexplorer.org. That's all for today's show. Our producer is Eric Bork. Our assistant producer is Hannah Duro. Outdoor Explorer will be back next week. My name is Charles Woolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.